My name is David Livingstone. I've been studying the occult for 30 years now, and I've written five books. My latest is a six volume, which is effectively a culmination of all my years of research. It's called Ordo Ap Cal, which is available online in print and in Kindle. And what I've tried to do all this time is not only study the influence of the occult in our time, but to trace its origins. There's a lot of myths and legends associated with the purported legends of the occult, and I try to trace their true origins to better understand what's happening.
Although many people might not agree with calling it the occult, the thing that I think many people can agree with is that whether it's the arms lobby or the, for example, the financial lobbies, that it's really a tiny number of people that steer society, that have these kind of key powerful positions in and make these key decisions about war and peace, these kinds of things. I just wonder, how you can convince people that actually to go one step beyond that, if you want, but rather than just looking at this as a powerful financial lobby or whatever, that there's something more to it.
Well, the problem is that it takes a little bit of a leap before you develop the interest to understand, right? To believe in the existence of a conspiracy, it's difficult because it goes against our basic understanding of the world, I think, is it because it sounds too big to be true, right? It sounds too complicated to manage. Most people can't understand that with the world as large and as complex it is, that it's possible for a small group of people to exercise any sufficient degree of influence. So yeah, it's really hard for people to make that leap. It just seems too big. I think the first step is to understand how the power is possible. First of all, to understand which institutions give power, and then or which institutions contribute to a hole in power, and then how those institutions are who they consist of. So you can start to see who's involved, what their agendas are. And you can start to see how a certain degree of control is managed. Beyond that, I think once you start to look at who the perpetrators are, you start to see a certain set of beliefs, political outlook, expectations, agendas that start to link back to each other. And so that's the key, is once you recognize the underlying belief system that connects them all, if you start to trace it, it traces back to the occult. And then, of course, when you start to trace the history of the occult, you start to see that this is a pattern that is not a recent one, but that goes back many centuries, and that most of the people who have been made out, who have been celebrated as some of the most influential people, particularly in Western history, usually the reason they have been is because they have made a substantial contribution or played a particular role in the preservation of the occult tradition.
Now, your Ordo Ab Chao book, this is Order from Chaos. This is the motto of the Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Do you want to just say a little bit about them, who they are? And also, I think, for a lot of people now, they're looking at the world, they see it as either dysfunctional, but certainly it seems like there are these kind of lords of chaos in charge, where it's almost as if society is being deliberately directed towards a chaotic state. I mean, some people will say, well, actually, it's just mismanagement. But there's more and more people now saying, well, this seems deliberate.
Yeah, so you mentioned that some people don't like the word the occult, and the reality is that we often say occultism which is it's a convenient way of avoiding saying Satanism. You know, not all cult is satanic, but and not all Satanism is a cult. But in this case, what we are talking about is a cult, is satanic occultism. So it goes back to Babylon in the 6th century BC, the development of a tradition that merged the worship of underworld gods with the Babylon history of magic and astrology. And so this is basically what came to be in the Jewish tradition came to be known as Kabbalah. It's basically it's a heresy of Judaism. And so it's, you know, the early practitioners would present themselves to the world as merely being an interpretation of Judaism, basically as a way of disguising their apostasy from Judaism. And what it's based on is the idea that Solomon had learned magic somehow from you know, basically some kind of discarded entities, demonic entities of some sort, and that he used that power to build, first of all, that he had a sigil, or, you know, the Star of David, or the Star of Solomon, was a six-pointed star, which he used as a seal on a ring, apparently, to control these demons. And then he used his control over these demons to build the temple of Solomon. So there is a legitimate Orthodox tradition in Judaism that looks forward to the rebuilding of the temple as, you know, part of fulfillment of Bible prophecy with the return of the Messiah. And there's a parallel satanic tradition, occult Kabbalistic tradition, that also aspires to rebuilding of the third temple, but their Messiah is the Antichrist. So that's why when you look at a group like the Knights Templar, for example, which is really where modern Western occultism begins, they are founded again on the idea of this reconstruction of the temple. And so this is how their place in history was appropriated by the Freemasons, who continued this concept of rebuilding of the temple. So they're called Masons, or bricklayers, because supposedly they are laying the bricks for the foundations of effectively a new world order, which is to be governed by the expected Messiah, who is going to, they're laying the bricks for the rebuilding of the Temple of Solomon, the third temple. And so, as I said, this is understood to them to be a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. There's a, you know, the rebuilding of the temple is, you know, central to Jewish expectation, but it's also found, of course, in the book of Revelation, which turns out to be effectively used as a template for them to follow. And this is according to Albert Pike, who wrote Morals and Dogma. He's the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, wrote the Morals and Dogma, which served very much as a kind of Bible of Freemasonry. And he explains that the book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic book, a coded book. And so effectively, it outlines the plan that they are to follow. So they want to actively work towards fulfilling Bible prophecy, which is why they are, you know, by analogy, reconstructing the third temple. What they're doing is rebuilding the third temple. And to
that is interesting. Hang on, though, because I mean, I don't know if Albert Pike's been reading Revelation correctly, or maybe he's been inventing bits of it. But the culmination of the book is a description of the New Jerusalem descending from heaven. And it actually specifically says in there that there's no temple within it, that the actual presence of God is just the light of God throughout the city, and that it actually says in Revelation there is no temple within. You know, so there's something specifically kind of running counter to what Pike is saying.
Well, I mean, it's a Luciferian tradition, which is, you know, surprisingly taking the same prophecies, but you know, siding with the opposite camp. So they're siding with the camp of the Antichrist because they believe that they are at war with God, who is unjust.
Anyway, can you say something about the Templars? Because I know that there were, back in medieval times, there were several crusades. It was something which was launched from Rome, you know, as opposed to Constantinople, because there were two separate churches, as there still are, the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And I think it was the second or third crusade ended up with an absolutely horrific massacre in Constantinople, very, very convenient for the Pope, of the Orthodox Church. And in fact, almost all, I think, the residents of Constantinople were slaughtered. This was the Templars that were responsible for this. They're obviously an interesting crew. One of the basic things about them is they were kind of French-based. They had bases in Britain, of which Bristol was one. They had Edinburgh too. And London, the famous Temple Church in London, which is now the centre for the legal profession, much of the legal profession. The other thing is that they had an immunity from the law because they were sanctioned by the Catholic Church, and they didn't have to sort of obey, really, the laws of the individual lands that they were in, which is obviously quite handy, putting them above the law. So who were they?
So the Templars, basically, so the first crusade, first of all, we have to understand, you know, who led the first crusade. So the first crusade is called the Prince's Crusade. It had a number of leaders. The most famous one is Godfrey of Bouillon. And so all these, basically, they belong to a group of families that were leaders of French and British aristocracy. And so what I saw in my book is how interrelated all these families are. And, you know, I'm not going to name all the details, but, you know, one important locus is what's called the Abbey of Cluny in France. And it was founded by a William of Aquitaine. He was a grandson. So there's a lot of legends that surround this. And so it's hard to know exactly what's true. But apparently this William of Aquitaine was the grandson of a Guillaume of Cologne, who's famous in the French early medieval romances. And so the legend is that he was the son of a Rabbi Makir, who was sent in exile from Babylon. So the Jewish community in the Islamic world were ruled by a figure, political figure, known as an exilarch, who claimed descent from David. So it was a hereditary title, because, as you know, the Messiah is supposed to descend from David, be the son of David. So there's a dispute, and so the one who lost the appointment to the title basically found his way to the West and to France. So that's how he basically, there's a book, it's called Sefer HaKabbalah, which explains that he basically became interrelated, quote unquote, with the family of Charlemagne. And this is how supposedly, you know, they gave birth to this Guillaume of Cologne. So when you look at the families involved in the First Crusade, they're all intricately related with each other and can all trace their descent back to this Guillaume of Cologne. And why that's important is because they appear to have prized their sort of Davidic descent. So they appear to have been aware that they had this sacred bloodline that they were preserving, because they were effectively preserving the bloodline of the Messiah. When you look at all these families, again, they're all the families that are interrelated. Like, one of the important leaders of the First Crusade was Stephen of Blois. And I can't remember his relation, but I think he was a stepbrother of Hugh of Champagne. Hugh of Champagne was one of the founders of the Templars, and he was associated with a very important figure in Jewish history known as Rashi, and considered one of the most, you know, important figures in the history of Judaism, particularly medieval Judaism in particular. And he's also considered one of the early figures in the history of Zionism, because he claimed he was one of the first to propose that the Jews were entitled to the land of Jerusalem. So it's interesting that, you know, this early Zionist project was very closely affiliated with the Templars. And so Rashi was also was in contact with a number of Christians, in particular a guy named Stephen Hardin, who was associated with Bernard of Clairvaux, who was the patron saint. Sorry, not the patron saint, the patron of the Templars. And it's effectively through the effort of Bernard of Clairvaux that the founding of the Templars was sanctioned by the Pope. So the Templars, to make a long story short, they became enormously powerful. They are considered sort of the first international bankers. They gained so much power that apparently the Catholic Church, well, there's one of the reasons why the Catholic Church was concerned about them, but the other reason was because of the satanic rites that they apparently practiced. So they apparently had rituals involving sodomy and urinating on the cross and what's called the obscene kiss, which is kissing the devil in the form of a black cat on the anus. And this is a particular ritual which was very common throughout most of the circles of witchcraft at the time. It was also known amongst the Cathars, another Luciferian sect. And so the Cathars are also, you know, really central to this entire history, occult history. They figure very much in the lore of the Holy Grail. So what's interesting, of course, then is the claim is that, so Philip le Bel, Philip the Fourth, I think, of France, is the one who ordered the arrest of the Templars. So the common history you'll hear throughout, basically not only just Masonic history, but most mainstream history, is they accuse him of being greedy and wanting to appropriate the wealth and power of the Templars. But the reality is that you can look at the true history of the Templars, and in particular, I'd recommend a book by Malcolm Barber, which is called The Trial of the Templars. And this is a respected academic study of the Templars, and he points out that there was a number of confessions that were obtained through torture, but there were also confessions that were obtained without torture. And even some of those confessions that were obtained through torture, the Templars who made those confessions admitted that they didn't make those confessions because of the torture. So basically you have, you know, this is one of the first early orders, because, you know, these accusations of witchcraft, this is before what they call the burning times, before witchcraft became more widespread. Again, you found them amongst groups like the Cathars, but this is one of the first early reported admissions of devil worship, you know, that were made at that time, and made in this case in one of the most politically powerful orders of the time. And that is largely the reason why, you know, in secret, the Templars were believed to have, you know, preserved some kind of secret and are revered ultimately by first the Rosicrucians and then finally the Freemasons.
Some people have said that actually without the Templars and the assault on the Holy Land, and let's not forget that there is this incredible letter of Prester John, which was circulated around Europe, complete nonsense. But the idea was that that there was this Christian king that was fighting the Muslims on the other side of the Holy Land somewhere. No one was quite sure where. Basically, yeah. Because it was made up. And this was circulated around really to kind of guilt trip various nobility who weren't contributing enough either themselves personally by going to fight or sending their soldiers or money to the Crusades. So this letter was circulated as well. But, I mean, some have said that actually the Templars sparked the growth of Islam. Do you think that's true?
No, because Islam came several centuries after before. But what is true is that there was an important relationship between the Templars and an occult Islamic group called the Assassins, and that has a deep history that is considered significant until our time. So you have even people like William S. Burroughs, who is really a central figure in modern occultism, and he's another who revered the Assassins. So the Assassins basically were an Ismaili group. So there's two major sects in Islam. There's the Sunnis, and they represent about 80% of the Islamic population. There's a minority called a Shia sect. And then within Shiism, Shiism itself is divided into two sects. And one of them, the smaller one, is the Ismailis. And the Ismailis in particular veered, you know, substantially away from Islam. What's important is because this is, you know, when we talk about the Templars, we're talking about the first European manifestation of the occult. So, you know, the occult, as I mentioned earlier, it began in Babylon, flourished particularly in Roman times at Alexandria. And, you know, it manifested in various ways. Most important of them was the tradition of the ancient mysteries. And another one was Neoplatonism. Particularly with the Platonic Academy. And so what happened is that with the rise of the ascent of Christianity, the Platonic Academy was finally closed. And what happened is that a number of them found their way to this community in southwestern Turkey called Harran. And Harran is famous because this is where Abraham was made one of his stops. And, but in the Islamic, so by that time, by the time these Neoplatonists found their way there, it was already a famous occult community, that was, inhabited by an occult group known as the Sabians, which is another, Luciferian group. And what happened is that with one of the sultans, his name was, Al-Ma'mun, when he came through the city, I guess maybe he conquered the city of Harran, that he gave the people of Harran, or the Sabians, an ultimatum. They had to declare which people, what in Islam you have the people who are protected people, because in Islam you have basically a different minority setup where you have the civilization is governed by the religion of Islam, but the various, it's a pluralistic system so that the various minorities are allowed to coexist within the Islamic State, but to govern themselves according to their own rules. So a system very different from what happens in the West. This is why you have political figures like the Exarch, because he would be considered the leader of the Jewish community. And then so the people, community like the Christians, would be recognized people of the book. And other people are the Sabians, who claimed, I think they claimed descent from the Queen of Sheba. So the Sabians or Haranians, they had a few days, I think, to decide, how to describe themselves. They went and got some advice, and they were told to declare themselves as Sabians. So they weren't real Sabians because they weren't the real people of the Sabian tradition who are a recognized tradition in the Quran. They use this title in order to disguise themselves, and that's how they got away with it. So from that point forward, the Sabian community of Harran became exceptionally influential, and they had an influence in a variety of ways. One of them was in the mystical tradition in Islam known as Sufism, and the other was a community known as the Brethren of Sincerity. And it's out of the Brethren of Sincerity that you get who, first of all, influenced Sufism, and then secondly, the Brethren of Sincerity were an Ismaili group. And so this is how this sort of Sabian, Haranian tradition influenced the Assassins ultimately. And what's really interesting is that, you know, the the conquest of Jerusalem seems to have been a pretext. So they gathered this immense army. They went right through, you know, right past most, you know, any other important areas that they could have conquered. And they attacked Jerusalem specifically. Because what seems to have happened is that they conducted excavations beneath the temple, because I believe they were looking for something that they knew was probably there. So when, because when the second temple was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans, it's likely, you know, the Romans famously took a number of treasure, and this is why the Arch of Titus shows, you know, the Roman soldiers carrying away the treasures of the temple, most famously the large menorah candelabra. But it seems that, you know, likely a number of documents probably didn't manage to get removed in time. And it seems that somebody or someone believed that to be the case or knew it to be the case. So as I said, what happens is that immediately after the Templars are established, one of the first things they do is they bring this mission to Europe in 1128. One of the first things they do, I'll just mention it because it's important, they go to visit David I of Scotland, who again was part of this entire family network that could trace their descent to this Guillaume of Gaulle. So it's immediately after that period that you get the appearance of a book called the Sefer HaBahir. So this is the book that begins the history of the Kabbalah. So because when scholars speak about Kabbalah, this is the beginning that they're talking about. The Kabbalah, according to Gershom Scholem, is founded on a number of ancient esoteric ideas that can be traced back to the early centuries AD. But it's those ideas that help shape the later Kabbalah. And again, it's repeated to this book. And no one can explain how this book suddenly appeared. And so this is the purpose of at least so a number of books. So one of them is a book called Origins of the Kabbalah by Gershom Scholem. The other one is same question by Moshe Edel. Another one by Nathaniel Deutsch, which is called A Gnostic Imagination. And what they're looking at is they look at the Sefer HaBahir, and they can't understand how could the ideas in this book have suddenly emerged into this book when these ideas had been effectively forbidden in Judaism for nearly 1,000 years. So one of the cases that they look at is one possibility of survival is the Sabians of Haran. So it means that there's a multiple channels here that are happening, that it's contact with the Templar contact with the assassins, which could have been one of the conduits for the Sabian ideas, and the other one would have been the Sefer HaBahir, because according to tradition, the book appeared in, I believe, Germany first as a tattered bits, sort of like broken bits, almost as if it had been, you know, an ancient scroll that had been discovered, and I believe probably excavated in Jerusalem. So this is how you have all these overlapping histories, and this is why it's so crucial, because this Sefer HaBahir not only gives birth to the traditions of the Kabbalah, but in turn, the dissemination of the Kabbalah gives rise to occult Christian groups like the Cathars. And it's this tradition that ultimately gets transformed into the legends of the Holy Grail, particularly, but all the members of this aristocratic network that were all involved in leading what's called the Prince's Crusade to achieve the conquest of Jerusalem.
For me, one of the most interesting books which brings a lot of this stuff up to date is called Born in Blood, The Lost Secrets of Freemasonry. I mean, there's so many books saying this is the lost secrets of Freemasonry, you can't count them. But this I found very, really excellent, you know, making those very definite connections between the Templars and the Masons, you know, even just the idea of the lodge being somewhere that one of these Templar witches basically could hide after Philip the Fair had them banned in throughout Europe and in England. Actually, apparently, it took a long time to do it. I'm not sure they were ever totally banned in Scotland, so it might be that that's where they ran off to. But that's back to what you were talking about. I mean, you're describing there quite an amazing scene during the Crusades where you seem to have, and maybe, you know, clarify if I've not got you right, a Templar version of Christianity, which is totally fraudulent and Luciferian, and a similar thing going on in Islam with the Assassins. And actually the two, even though what we're seeing is that this organization has got the Muslims and the Christians fighting, it's actually secretly organizing this as a Luciferian kind of duopoly behind the scenes.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, what's really interesting is that one of the people who played an enormous role in occultism in modern times, who influenced most of the leading occultists, the founding occultists of modern times, his name is Jamaluddin al-Afghani. And he was born in Iran, which means that he was a Shia, but he basically presented himself as a Sunni. Every country he went to, he was kicked out. He ended up in Egypt, where he became Grand Master of the Masonic Lodge of Egypt. And so he contributed to the formation of three important traditions. So the first one is that he was the leading exponent of the most important reform movement in Islam in modern times, known as Salafism, which became very closely linked with Saudi Arabia. And so this is the movement that evolved, first of all, into the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood was the organization which was chiefly responsible for basically all Islamic terrorism in modern times. I believe that Osama bin Laden was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And basically, so you have the Salafi tradition, you know, continuing their collaboration. And there was a very close collaboration between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Nazis, who basically worked hand in hand. And this is what, not only from their founding, but basically all through much of the century, you find that, you know, people like Otto Skorzeny were collaborating with the Muslim Brotherhood. And then right up until, you know, very recently, there was close ties between the Muslim Brotherhood and neo-Nazis. So now when you look at the Nazis themselves, the Nazis developed their ideas from those of Helena Blavatsky. And so Helena Blavatsky, she gained her teachings, channeled her teachings effectively from a number of Senate masters. And it's an author, his name is K. Paul Johnson. He's written a couple of books, and both of them make the case that Afghani was also one of her ascended masters. And there's a number of connections because he was close friends of Helena Blavatsky. And you can trace Blavatsky's travel itinerary, and Afghani happened to be in the same place in the most times, in many of those times. So, because apparently Afghani was a member of this so-called Brotherhood of Luxor, and this became an immensely influential organization, eventually known as the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, which was an organization which taught Sabbatian sex magic. And one of the members of this group was, so basically out of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, you get basically the birth of modern occultism, influencing organizations like the Golden Dawn, the OTO that Aleister Crowley belonged to. And another person involved was René Guénon, who's a key figure in what's called traditionalism. So Guénon was also part of this other tradition, which is central to the 20th century, which is called Synarchism. And Synarchism was founded by a man named Saint-Yves d'Alvedre. And again, always connecting back to the same families, that when you look at the families who were involved in the Crusades, even though they lost Jerusalem, and I think it was 1290, back to the Muslims, these are families who continued to hold the titles of kings of Jerusalem, because they understood that you know, in their bloodline was this descent from David. So effectively, they're preserving the bloodline of the Messiah. So all these families now were central. One of the most important ones was the families of Hessen-Kessel. And the families of Hessen-Kessel can trace themselves back to particularly the Knight of the Swan. A lot of these families, this is how they could, this is where they sort of traced the importance of their descent, because the Knight of the Swan was apparently the father of Godfrey of Bouillon. And then his brother married, I can't remember who his brother married, but somehow this line of descent survived through his brother. And this is how you get, you know, the descent of the Scottish aristocracy. And then again, now this family of Hessen-Kessel. And the family of Hessen-Kessel were central to the Illuminati. So one of the central figures, his name was Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel. It was with this family, it was with their father or their brother, that the Rothschilds began their career. They began their career basically building their wealth as bankers to this family. And so Charles of Hessen-Kessel then also became the Grand Master of the Order of the Asiatic Brethren. So the Asiatic Brethren was a Frankist organization founded by the cousin or nephew of the founder of Jacob Frank, who was supposedly a successor of Sabbatai Zvi. And so this Asiatic Brethren, they're the ones who, they became known in occult history, more modern occult history, as the Fratres Lucis. And this is the organization that ultimately evolved into the Golden Dawn. The reason why they're called Asiatic Brethren is because ultimately they're supposed to be a reference to the Eastern mystics that the Templars had come into contact with. So effectively, the Sabian tradition that had been transmitted to them through the Assassins. And so back to Saint Yves d'Albert. So he learned, basically, he's the one who put forward this idea of Agartha, which was supposedly a sacred realm somewhere in Tibet, which is governed by some kind of mystical entities. And he learned of this idea from a man named Haji Sharif, known as an Afghan prince, who effectively was just another alias of Jamal Afghani. And Jamal Afghani, he made this very important admission. Historians tend to look at the Western occult as being, you know, really the key figures. So Blavatsky, Saint Yves d'Albert, René Guénon, Aleister Crowley were really, in fact, you know, all of these characters, you can trace the influence you can trace back to is this Jamal Afghani. And what's, again, this is what I wanted to mention. So what's interesting about Jamal Afghani is that he used to, in the Masonic Lodge in Egypt, where he was Grand Master, they used to refer to themselves as a brethren of sincerity, so overtly identifying themselves with the original brethren of sincerity who had influenced not only, again, the Sufi tradition of Islam, but most importantly, the Ismaili assassins. And so this is how, word for word, this is exactly what Afghani admitted. He said, "We do not cut off the head of religion except with the sword of religion. Therefore, if you were to see us now, you would see ascetics and worshippers kneeling and genuflecting, never disobeying God's commands and doing all that they are ordered to do." So this is how he could disguise himself. I mean, he's a reputable Islamic reformer, you know, immensely influential in modern Islamic theology, played an enormous role in shaping the direction of theology of Islam in at least the last century. So, but as you can see, he was also at the same time probably the most important figure in the modern Luciferian tradition. So now you can see how people like this operate and how, in his case, he can use the cover of Islam to destroy Islam. And in the same way, you have people using the cover of Christianity, claiming maybe to be priests, claiming to be theologians, claiming to be mystics, claiming to be devout, but ultimately they are devoted to Christianity's destruction, because their goal is the destruction of all religions, particularly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, because it's a Luciferian agenda, which is again opposed to God, who they regard as unfair, and they view Satan as their liberator.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you talk about the Golden Dawn for them, of course, is the Eastern faiths taking over and really sweeping the world and sweeping the monotheistic faiths based on the Old Testament off the earth.
Right, exactly. It's a Luciferian conspiracy. They're out to fulfill, again, the prophecies of the end times, but from the side of Satan.
I mean, it's all very well talking about the Templars today, David, but what, I mean, it's what's the relevance today? Because, you know, as you've described, these groups are very well organized, actually, like wheels within wheels, and in different ages, they manifest themselves in different ways. So, yeah. For example, it may be, you know, a bunch of Knights Templar sacking Constantinople in one age. In another age, it might be a Nazi concentration camp destroying the rabbinic tradition in Europe. What about today, though?
Well, I mean, you're seeing it everywhere today, right? It's in fact, I was rereading today the evolution of how Europeans, modern societies have been shaped, right? So what's important is that before the modern European politics, societies were always run by empires, right? And the purpose of an empire is that usually it had some kind of guiding ideology or religion that it implemented in the form of a state, and that it would absorb as much territory as possible. And there were different ways that this was achieved. And you had examples like you had the Persian Empire, for example, where it was still possible for a number of different nationalities to coexist. So, you know, the Persian Empire was unique, you know, as an early example of a pluralistic empire where they allowed different religions to exist within the empire. And again, the Islamic Empire was the same, right? So what you have today is kind of a reversal, where you have the existence of states. And these states are to be governed, they effectively by a sort of an artificial unifying principle, which is usually a shared tradition, a shared culture, an ethnic identity, a language. So instead of the governing ideal of the society being some kind of an ideology, it tends to be something more, let's say, more contrived and less meaningful in a sense, because this is even how you get to the point where you get the concept of race as being the basis of nationalism. So what's interesting is that the Rosicrucian movement emerged in 1618 when they try to hand over the crown of Bohemia to Frederick V of the Palatinate. Again, he is part of this same family network. And what that did is that it immediately upset the Habsburgs and began their 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War concluded with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. And so the Peace of Westphalia is considered to have laid the foundation for the modern creation, the modern concept of sovereignty. So instead of empires, you now have these states, because effectively we have to understand that this is the ultimate goal of the, you know, New World Order, is to create this global federation. So this is why you have that these societies, their goal, and you can trace the history of it all. So it goes from the Peace of Westphalia, then the Congress of Vienna in 1815 after the defeat of Napoleon, which again further divided, created most of the early modern states. And then again, the revolutions of 1848, which were all conducted by underground secret societies, and again led to the formation of the states. I have an entire chapter in my book on the Carbonari, which talks about, in particular, the formation, the unification of Germany, and also the unification of Italy, again by secret societies, particularly the unification movement in Italy, which was led by Giuseppe Mazzini, who was reportedly the successor to Adam Weishaupt as head of the Illuminati. And you can see this entire network working underground within all these revolutions, all tied to various Masonic traditions that are working towards the formation of these states, because ultimately you can see how these states continue to concretize in the 20th century. And ultimately, you know, one of the main accomplishments of the 20th century was first the creation of League of Nations, which was effectively a failure, but ultimately the United Nations, which is the beginning of this step of towards achieving this federation. Because we have to understand that, again, the goal of these secret societies is to work towards the establishment of a world kingdom to be governed by the Messiah. So they've done their homework, and it seems to be that they've interpreted that he is going to have to be somehow the leader of a global state. And it appears to be that the most effective means of establishing a global state is dividing the world into various nation states. And this is effectively how they created, you know, the concept of nationalism to create pockets throughout the world where people could appropriate this false identity to claim now that they are members of a particular nation. And so that, yeah, ultimately now you have the world divided in all these multiple states. And, you know, if I'm not sure if the United Nations is going to play that role, or some organizations was going to be born out of it. But ultimately, again, you know, the goal is this kind of world federation, which is to be governed in the end by who they believe them is this Messiah, but ultimately is effectively the Antichrist.
Just before Christmas, we had quite an interesting talk by a guy who does a blog. He's a Catholic in the Vatican, but he's obviously, well, he's not very closely associated with the Vatican. He does a lot of blogging about, for example, the whole COVID business, the war in Ukraine, these kinds of things. He's an independent Catholic called Alexis Bugnolo. And he was saying, well, actually, we need to stand up against this new empire, which is emerging from behind the scenes, starting to take over. He describes it as demonic feudalism, David.
Right. I mean, I mostly agree with what he's saying. I'm not sure how his characterization is accurate or how he intends to mean it. But, I mean, it just reminds me that, you know, one of the most important agendas that came out of, because I mentioned Giuseppe Mazzini, he was a member of the Carbonari. And one of the primary goals of the Carbonari was to install a Masonic Pope. And they came very close to succeeding when Cardinal Rampolla was elected Pope in the early 19th century. I'm sorry, I can't remember what year exactly. Who reportedly, and this is according to their own literature, was a member of Aleister Crowley's OTO. So that election was quashed by the Habsburgs. So it failed, and I can't remember what Pope was finally elected instead. But there's numerous rumors amongst some very prominent occultists that failed election of Cardinal Rampolla finally succeeded with Vatican II. And so Vatican II appears very much to have been the culmination of the success of this, you know, Illuminati plot, or Masonic plot, effectively is what it is, to hijack the Catholic Church. And from what I can tell, ever since then, the Catholic Church has very much been walking hand in hand with this conspiracy and plot.
What about links between Crowley and Hollywood? I've seen a lot of allegations that he spent a lot of time over in the early days of Hollywood with people like Meyer Lansky over in the States. Do you know much about that?
Well, you know, one of his important proteges was L. Ron Hubbard, right, the founder of Scientology. And there's a very important chapter, the Agape Lodge, which was founded by Jack Parsons, also in Hollywood. And so it's from there, really, that you get the, you know, much of the satanic network in Hollywood, because it's out of that grouping. This is what I treat in a chapter called The Church of Satan, because the Church of Satan was founded by the Church of Satan is grounded by a group called the Magic Circle, that was founded by Anton LaVey and Kenneth Anger, an experimental filmmaker. And so this is where you get this entire circle of, you know, Parsons Agape Lodge, the Church of Satan, Crowley's OTO, the Solar the Solar Temple of the OTO, I think is what it's called. And so, in fact, there's an entire blog by David McGowan about Laurel Canyon that really exposes a lot of these connections. And this is where you get the group, particularly in the late 60s, that were affiliated with Charles Manson, like the Mamas and the Papas, the Beach Boys, the same group that were associated with Roman Polanski, who filmed Rosemary's Baby, which is, of course, an account of a coven trying to give birth to the Antichrist. And Rosemary's Baby was produced by Robert Evans. Robert Evans is a very interesting character, very influential in Hollywood. And he was connected with a guy, I can't remember his name now, who was associated with the Process Church. So, of course, Process Church is a group that influenced Charles Manson. And, you know, just to list all the numerous connections, so who was connected to the Process Church was the Son of Sam killings. And this is all exposed by an amazing book by Maury Terry, which I highly recommend. There's also a documentary on Netflix about it. I think it's called Sons of Sam. And the Son of Sam apparently attended parties held by Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn is really a very crucial character. He's the one who really began this entire blackmail network that evolved into Jeffrey Epstein's network. And of course, Roy Cohn was a mentor to Donald Trump. And that's just a smattering of, you know, just a few of the connections. That's really where the connections begin. And then you have all the other, you know, the various people in Hollywood that are tied to them in some way.
Now, I think probably one of the most important bits of work you've done recently, David, if I might say so, is on transhumanism. And so this, I suppose, I mean, looking at it, it almost seems as if you've got Yuval Noah Harari writing about this, and many of the rich and powerful part of this group basically just reading his stuff and regurgitating it. You've also got banks saying, well, this looks like it's probably going to be the future, and so they're funding it, you know, because obviously they want to invest in something which is going to be big in the future. And in a way, it's almost like we're all following someone else's dream in transhumanism. Can you just say a bit about how that links back into this finally?
Well, I mean, the transhumanism is central to this Antichrist conspiracy, right? So the goal is, as I mentioned, is to create this global federation of states to be governed by the Antichrist. But the question is, who is the Antichrist? And so the Antichrist is supposedly a son of David, so he's supposed to descend from these various aristocratic families. You know, probably the person who's most important to have claimed the title of King of Jerusalem, who played a central role in the modern conspiracy and is a descent of the entire bloodline, was Otto von Habsburg. And Otto von Habsburg was also the founder of the group, the Pinay Circle, the Cercle Pinay. And that is basically the umbrella organization that ties almost all of the far-right groups, fascist groups in modern times. And that's really the core of where the conspiratorial influence is. But where it goes back to is the idea of cybernetics. And so out of cybernetics, you have two traditions. that came out of it. So one of them was MKUltra, and the other one was the computer. And there's a reason why those two operate in parallel. So the point of MKUltra was to use drugs and ritual trauma to create psychic children, who then would be able to communicate the information, channeled information, which is used by these people to govern their actions, to guide their actions. And then so in parallel, you have the birth of the personal computer. And so the goal of the computer wasn't to create a computer. The goal was to create artificial intelligence. And so, you know, the best way to understand the ultimate goal that they're trying to reach. So not only they're trying to create artificial intelligence, they're also trying to create a global brain. So the idea is to have this massive global computer that will have will be run by artificial intelligence and will have access to the accumulation of human knowledge, so that every book, every article, anything that's been published any time in history at its disposal, as well as all the actions of every human being on the planet Earth. There's a great logo that was created by the Total Information Awareness Program of DARPA, which has it's a globe, and then beside it there's a pyramid with the all-seeing eye. The same pyramid as is found in the back of the American dollar bill, and you can see that it's casting its rays on the entire globe. So basically, this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to create this all-seeing eye, which is to be worshipped as a god. And how this ties into MKUltra and transhumanism, I think we've talked about this before. I've mentioned that the movie that explains all of this is Lucy. And Lucy is curious because the name Lucy is important in two ways. It's the name that was given to the skeleton, the first woman, first female human, discovered by S.B. Leakey, and he named it Lucy. And apparently the name was inspired by Lucy in the Sky and Diamonds, which, as popularly known, is supposed to be a reference to LSD. And LSD, of course, is the key drug of the MKUltra program. So what the movie suggests is that the key main character, she's able to take this drug, which makes her achieve super intelligence until the point where she's able to merge with a computer. So this is kind of one of the goals of transhumanism. This is actually an idea that they have. You know, they are so fundamentally materialistic that they believe that the brain is just a biological fleshy computer. And they believe that it will be possible to replicate a person. So they don't really have a concept of the soul. They believe it will be possible to replicate the person, and that person will be possible to upload that person to a computer, and therefore they will reach immortality.
I mean, surely Lucy might just be Lucifer. I mean, is that simple?
Point. Yeah, very possibly. It's yes, I think so.
So particularly on the transhumanism, I mean, I think if people want to catch up with what's going on, they really need to pick up on this History of a Dangerous Idea book of yours. Whereabouts can we find you and follow, your latest books and also, of course, your AudoAbCao?
Right. So I maintain a website. It's AudoAbCao.ca. That's where I have my bio. I have links to all my previous books. So there you can find links to all my books that are available on Amazon. You can easily find PDF copies as well, too, through a Google search online of most of my books. On my website as well is my latest book, which is Order Ab Cow, again, in 6 volumes, which is entirely online. And there's also links available to the print version, which can be purchased on Amazon, as well as a Kindle version.
And for anyone interested in the Templars, who's in Bristol, we've got the Temple Church, which is the famous Leaning Tower, on the street between Union Street, I know Victoria Street, between Bristol Bridge and Bristol Templemeads Station. Whoops, Templemeads, right next to which is a big pub called the Knights Templar. And the actual original spot where the Templar boats ships would moor is on Welshback, which is just off Baldwin Street, which, of course, as David will tell you, well, I'm not going to let him because I will. He is, well, it was several Baldwins who were kings of Jerusalem. So much of this stuff is written into our street names and place names here in Bristol. Correct. David Livingstone, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony.